to prevent Israeli cinnamons products from entering into the EU's markets. BDS, anti-Israel movement promoting boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against Israel, praised the move and hoped for further measures against the occupying regime.
It's an important move in the right direction. We have repeatedly demanded the European Parliament to ban goods from Israeli settlements because of crimes committed by the Israeli regime.
Many European Union nations decided to only label imported Israeli products that are produced in settlements in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in the Golan Heights. Palestinian experts say barring goods produced in illegal settlements from entering into the EU markets will serve as a heavy blow to Israel, mainly because settlement goods are exported directly to European markets.
This reflects the European public opinion's main stance on the Palestinian cause. The petition is now going through its legal stages in the European Parliament. We hope it could be approved as a law in the future.
The cutting of Israeli products around the world has been growing rapidly in recent years and caused heavy losses to Israeli companies. Thousands of volunteers, trade unions, NGOs, academic and business societies, as well as cultural figures worldwide, have joined the boycott campaign to help promote the Palestinian cause. Most European countries don't deal with settlement products in the same way as Israeli products. They don't label them as being produced in Israel. But the most important for the Palestinians would be when the EU prohibits import and sale of goods, services, and natural resources originating from illegal Israeli settlements. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts. The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war. Afghan Taliban and the US signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the US troops withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the US and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment. At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming US president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course.
On paper, there seems no change in the policy of US President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan. But he may not hasten the troops withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
In recent years, the U.S. Federal Reserve has reported multiple times that 40% of Americans don't have the cash to cover just a $400 emergency. Then COVID hit. The lack of savings is now almost twice as bad. A recent poll by the Highland Consultancy reveals that a stunning 82% of Americans now don't have the savings for a $500 emergency. It's a shocking reminder that the wealth in the richest nation in the world is distributed in a shockingly unequal fashion. For the average American household, $500 is equal to half a month's housing costs, 3 weeks of transportation, 2 weeks of childcare for one child, and less than a month of food.
If human needs are met, then people can put money away for emergencies. But when you're living where you can barely feed yourself, and where you can barely meet your housing needs, how can you possibly put money away?
In the decentralized United States, uneven, often draconian lockdowns are entering their ninth month, but there hasn't been any government help since a federal package in March. The result is a bevy of simply atrocious data, which reveals the financial suffering of the average American. 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck since the pandemic began. public sector wages recently had their biggest monthly drop ever. New weekly jobless claims were greater than the worst week of the Great Recession for the 39th straight week. 800 small businesses have closed every day nationwide since April. Clearly, America's Main Street was already teetering on the edge prior to Corona.
We've got a society that's structured towards not meeting basic needs. That's important to everybody in the economy, that it have a sound foundation. And if you have people who are desperate in your, on your foundation, the economy is always in danger of collapsing.
Corona deaths keep rising, the economy keeps plummeting, except for rich assets like stocks, and it's still not certain who won the presidential election. The U.S. is in the middle of its worst crisis since the 1930s, but it might be even worse than that. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his country will no longer be affected dramatically by U.S. sanctions. He also accused the U.S. of imposing sanctions on Turkey to prevent it from becoming independent and developing its own defense sector. Erdogan's comments came after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey's defense industries and its chief.
This decision is a blatant assault on our nation's sovereign rights. This has been imposed for the first time against us, a NATO member. What kind of an alliance is this? Now we will work twice as hard to make our defense industry fully independent.
Turkey has always criticized the U.S. for its unilateral actions against other countries in the region, such as Iran.
This is not the first time that the U.S. imposes unnecessary sanctions on other countries. The sanctions come as a punitive act against any country trying to become independent. But I think that Turkey will overcome the sanctions.
Washington had already punished Ankara in July by barring it from developing parts for and acquiring America's next-generation F-35 fighter jets. Earlier, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned what he called U.S. addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law. The sanctions cut off Turkey's top defense procurement agency from U.S. financial institutions, military hardware, and technology. Ties between the two NATO allies, Turkey and the U.S., were strained last year due to Ankara's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia. However, Turkey says it had to resort to Moscow to meet its needs after its own allies stopped responding to its demands. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
Studying in military academies and in armed forces organizations is one of the loftiest and most valuable endeavors. Why? It is so because by studying these universities, our youth enter the armed forces with the purpose of ensuring the security of the country, and security is a noble and fundamental value for the country. It is a vital element because without it, all other important values of the country will be disrupted. Values including welfare, justice, pursuit of knowledge, and other such values. Therefore, presence in these universities is a very important opportunity and a very valuable task. Studying and graduating from these academies will prepare you for being engaged in one of the most valuable endeavors, that of ensuring the security of your country and your nation.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, apart from ensuring security, the armed forces have other important duties, one of the most important of which is rendering public services to the nation. The Army, the Guards Corps, the Police Force, and Basij have rendered all kinds of services to the Iranian nation in previous years, particularly in recent years, including infrastructural services and construction of dams, refineries, and the like. In the arena of health and treatment, the armed forces have accomplished a great feat by working in the area of polio vaccines. Today, too, when it comes to the issue of coronavirus, the armed forces are really in the middle of the arena and they are presenting all necessary services. In the area of livelihood projects, many good tasks are being carried out by the armed forces. Of course, they do not announce and promote them in the media, but they are carrying out very satisfactory tasks, which we are aware of. We could equally refer to their participation in the Pious Assistance and Charity Movement.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Relations between China and the United States continue to deteriorate. From a trade war with Washington taxing and even sanctioning some Chinese entities, to the U.S.'s promoting Taiwan as a separate nation, to Washington's Navy presence in the Taiwan Strait, have all been techniques used to pressure Beijing. Now, the waters are very murky between the two right now. And we will take a look at what the future may hold for China-U.S. ties in this debate.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan. But some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope. It's trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman, out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angelo Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start this off with Lawrence. Now, Washington says Taiwan is a separate nation. China says it is part of the People's Republic of China. According to international law, it is one country with two governments. What does it all mean in your perspective?
This idea of China being one country with two governments has been accepted for many, many years. And to disrupt this political understanding is quite dangerous. The problem is that President Trump, even though he started out trying to establish friendly, cordial, amiable relations with President Xi Jinping, has deteriorated and now has adopted the geopolitical doctrine, which says that there's a zero-sum game in the world as a chessboard, and there are either winners or losers. And the United States has now determined under President Trump that it has to have hegemony and has to put down and keep under China, which is emerging as a great superpower and a very powerful economy. this doctrine is unfortunate, and it's a problem for both the United States and China and for the world, because it can get quite dangerous, as we're seeing in your description earlier.
Well, Angelo, why does the United States want to stir up this hornet nest with China, when both, as our previous guests said, I mean, as a matter of fact, with souring relations, it would appear that both actually would suffer. So why stir up this hornet nest?
I think the USA, they know too well that Taiwan, the pushing for Taiwan independence is the line not to cross, and this could be a case for war. So basically, the reason Taiwan is a pawn against China, so lately the US has invested deeply a lot into the DPP, which is the ruling party in Taiwan, and this party is advocating for independence. So China sovereignty over Taiwan is the line not to cross, and the U.S. is trying to use this as a pawn in either to probably to go into a negotiation of the coming new reset of the new world order, which would be which a lot of things would be renegotiated, including trading and currency and debt. So I think in the best case, it's a pawn for the decision. In the worst case, it's using Taiwan for putting a war in the region.
Okay, well, Lawrence, what do you think? Is the rift between the U.S. and China mostly because Washington cannot tolerate any other country except itself being on top, and China has already taken over the slot for having the largest economy, and it's threatening to surpass Washington in other fields?
Yes, well, this is a problem, because actually the U.S. interests, as an American, I know what the U.S. interests are, and the U.S. interests are not to be antagonistic to China. There are great things that the two superpowers and the two great economies, two largest economies, can accomplish in the future. So this is not in the American interest. What you have is you have an ideology best represented by people like Secretary of State Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and many, many others. They believe that China is a threat. It's not a threat. It can be a collaborator. It can be an ally in development in many areas, which I could outline. So this is a doctrine alien to actually what the United States stands for. We could be working with China on space and technology. We could be working with China on developing the rest of the world, including Africa. There are many areas of common interest. There is no basis for this conflict and this tension, which President Trump did not espouse when he first came into office. But unfortunately, he's given into it, and it also fits in with the prejudices of his base of supporters who are anti-China. Anti-China, China, China is not in the American interest. It's a danger to the United States. And if there ever was even the idea of decoupling the United States from China, it would be a disaster. And as our friend has reported, it is a causability for war if the United States keeps supporting Taiwan.
What about that, Angela? Do you agree with our previous guests? And if so, if it's not in the interests of the United States, whose interest is it in? Why are we seeing then this policy being implemented?
I think it's important to see who's really ruling the U.S. We have Biden and Trump in the face, but behind, there are people who have the informal power, which are the military complex and the bankers. So I think it's very important to know that those are only puppets in the front, just, you know, and behind, they're putting pressure because a lot of money, a lot of people are benefiting from war and from tensions, especially the military complex. So, and then I think there's a cultural problem in the U.S. because there's this culture of exceptionalism, to be the best and to want to export Western culture values. And there's a deep misunderstanding of China. I personally have lived 25 years in China, and I only now start to really understand what is behind the culture and what Chinese want. And while in the U.S. there's not this is not the slightest understanding of what China, the aspiration of China. China is not looking for hegemony. Has a history of not interfering in other countries' affairs, and what it wants is prosperity for its people. That's all it wants. So there's a deep misunderstanding, and so the hawks are just using the misunderstanding and the media just to further demonize China.
Yeah, what about that, Lawrence? Angela said some interesting things there, trying to demonize China, and there's a misunderstanding culturally. And that the United States or Americans always feel that they should be number one. But on the other hand, if we look at the advances of China, especially if we look at technologically, the U.S. is actually behind China technologically. And yet there's always this image, Americans themselves, that they should be number one. They have to be the best. And it appears almost that Washington will do anything in its power to stop competition, unfortunately, not in a fair way. Your take?
Unfortunately, over the last 50 years, I'm a senior citizen now, I've watched the whole process unfold. The United States culture has declined, has shrunk, and Americans don't think on the highest level these days. And Angela is correct. People don't know anything about China. If you look at Confucian philosophy, there is a coherence between Confucian philosophy and Judeo-Western culture in the idea of the common interest of mankind. China has performed a modern-day economic miracle in lifting 750 to 800 million people out of poverty. This could be a benefit to the world. China has just brought back Chang 5 with rocks from the moon, which we can now examine, which will benefit humanity. They also have put a rover on the far side of the moon. There's many things that China is doing in science and economics in terms of the Belt and Road and the infrastructure they're bringing to various nations of the world, including Africa. This is something that the United States has a shared interest in. It benefits all of mankind. And Angela is right. You have a military-industrial complex. You have a group of bankers, financial elite in Wall Street, in London, in Paris, who want to maintain their political power, its financial political power, and they see China and Russia to some extent attempting to usurp that power. That's geopolitics. There is no zero-sum game. Great nations can work together to accomplish great things for mankind. And as an American, I would plead with my fellow Americans to start thinking more strategically, more clearly, and don't buy into the propaganda that's coming out of Pompeo and the State Department.
Well, Angelo, do you see a different foreign policy approach with China under a Biden presidency as opposed to the current U.S. administration? Or do you think we're going to continually see this clash and perhaps even greater clashing? Your assessment?
I would say in the short term it might get better, but in the long term it might be more inclined to go to war. I think on the phone we saw Trump as being very arrogant, using not very appropriate words, but it's only the wording, it's only a facade. I don't think, I think we need to look at facts. No matter if we like or not Trump, in the last 4 years, he hasn't gone to war. While I would doubt that Biden would have his own war in China. So I think I'm very negative about Biden. Mm-hmm. I don't think he will get better.
So you're saying that under a Biden administration, you feel that it's going to be more hawkish than the previous administration?
Absolutely. If you look at the cabinet and the people surrounding Biden, they come from the Obama era and also from the Bush era. And those ones, they were all criminals. All criminals. Well, if you look at what they did in Libya, in Yemen, and around the world, they're just criminals. So basically, they need wars. Those Biden needs probably his war. Every president needs his war. And I think the possibilities of war are between, it could be Iran, it could be Venezuela, or it could be China. I think it's very hard to predict. But now we can see some advanced indicators that there's a continuation of a pivot to Asia, and this is not like a coincidence that we see warships in the South China Sea.
Well, Lawrence, how likely then, you've just heard, and what our other guests have said, in your perspective, how likely is it that these tensions could increase and actually lead to a military confrontation under a Biden term?
I would say there is increasing possibilities that could occur. If you look at the people that President-elect Biden has picked for his cabinet, they do come from the Obama crowd, which launched the Asian pivot in early 2011 against China. They come from some of them come from the Clinton administration, and you have a loud, ignorant chorus of voices coming out of the Democratic Party leadership and the Republican Party, all in an anti-China propagandist mode. And if you look at the people that Biden has, these are people around him who have carried out regime change, who have carried out sanctions, who have carried out and escalated wars. And even though people don't like President Trump's style, and I don't like it, he has not escalated any war. And I think under the Biden administration, we should definitely be concerned that the group of people he's now putting in his government, and he himself and other leading Democrats, could well lead us into a war. It's a very dangerous situation. Unfortunately, Trump has fallen into very bad policy advisors listening to them on China. So he's leaving the administration on a very sour note with China. And I think Biden will come in and may well escalate the antagonism between the two nations. And all it takes is a small incident somewhere in the South China Sea, and you could see the beginning of a military conflict. I'm very concerned about the Biden administration and its hawkish attitude toward China, which is already broadcast in various comments it's made. This is a serious, serious problem for us in the United States.
Angela, what about the use of sanctions? We've seen the U.S. now using sanctions to stop Chinese competition for American companies inside of the states, and they've even tried to put pressure on other countries to do the same. Do you see a continuation of this under a Biden administration, trying to block Chinese companies inside of the United States, and also making sure that Washington dictates to other countries to make sure that they also will sanction Chinese companies? How likely is that?
Absolutely. I think the direction the U.S. wants to take is towards decoupling. And I think we've seen Pompeo touring all around the world to pushing for countries to take sides. And this is a very big problem, especially in the Asian area. A lot of countries do not want to take sides. They want peace, but with the U.S., I think they will have a hard time just to have the countries to side with them. I think one of the very few countries in the region that is siding is Australia, but I don't see Japan and other countries siding for the U.S. So it's just a move to further isolate China, and I think this will not work.
And Lawrence, we're almost out of time, but your take, I mean, if you were given the opportunity to actually advise the new American administration that's going to take over in a couple of weeks, what would you say? What would be the way that the United States should be handling foreign relations with China?
I think the United States should recognize we have a common interest with China. As the two economic powerhouses in the world, there are many positive things we can do together. For example, space. Exploring space is one of the most important developments for mankind, to learn the laws of the universe, to discover them for all the benefit of mankind. We should also use China's Belt and Road in their elimination of poverty. I'm an African specialist, and we have 600 million people without electricity in Africa, 400 million people living in poverty. If the United States and China combine their forces and their outlook together and their powers, we could eliminate poverty in Africa and other parts of Southeast Asia. These are the kinds of wonderful things that could be done together. We could develop nuclear power, fusion energy, which we've been on the drawing board for a half a century. All these things are possible when powers like the United States and China would collaborate for the better, beneficial development of mankind.
Okay.
And this is what I represent, and this is what the United States should be.
Angela, your take. Do you think that China would actually be willing? You've just heard our other guests discuss the way forward. If he had an opportunity to tell the United States, do you think that China, Beijing, would be willing to cooperate and work with the Americans?
Absolutely. Beijing is looking every opportunity to reconcile with the U.S. He wants to share a future with the U.S. It's not either China or the U.S. They want to work for multipolar world. And I think this is a China becoming the largest superpower or just getting to the level of the U.S. I think it's a huge opportunity for the world. It's an opportunity just to go from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. It's an opportunity to get out of the American hegemony and the neocolonialism, because we are still half of the world is colonized. If you look at the impact, the pressure the U.S. is putting in South America and in Africa, I think with China would be very different. China could give back dignity to the greater South and could help him decolonize the world, but this is obviously what the U.S. doesn't want.
Okay.
I am for peace. I like very much what our colleague just said before. I am for peace. I think we have huge opportunities, but there are some evil forces that do not think the same as we do. And those evil forces are people, the bankers, and whoever is ruling now the U.S. And it's
okay.
A sad reality.
Unfortunately, I am out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angela Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Appreciate both of you being with us, and as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Beyond the starvation and malnutrition, war-torn Yemen has been the site of cholera epidemics and medical shortages so extreme and so long that some chronic illnesses like diabetes kill the bulk of those inflicted simply from going untreated too long. On top of that, Saudi airstrikes continue to kill large numbers of people, mainly civilians, and those strikes have fueled international outcry. Yet, no decisive action by the UN to force an end to the conflict and hold the Saudi-led culprits to account. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency. This article is published under the heading, Yemen is Still Suffering. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The U.S.-backed and Saudi-led war on Yemen has been a disaster for its long-suffering people from day one. Some 6 years into the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen, the United Nations is reporting that 233,000 people have been killed, calling this unacceptable and demanding both sides work on an immediate ceasefire to the conflict. Though a lot of people have been killed directly in the war, UN figures show the majority of the civilian death were from airstrikes, as well as lack of food and medicine, diseases, and lack of other general infrastructure. That's not a surprise. Beyond the starvation and malnutrition, war-torn Yemen has also been the site of cholera epidemics and medical shortages so extreme and so long that some chronic illnesses like diabetes killed the bulk of those inflicted simply from going untreated too long. No one is really healthy in Yemen. There is not food and medicine for that, but the really sick probably already died from the lack of treatment. On top of that, Saudi airstrikes continue to kill large numbers of people, mainly civilians, and those strikes have fueled international outcry. Yet no decisive action by the UN to force an end to the conflict and hold the Saudi-led culprits to account. Meanwhile, the United States and its European minions continue to sell the Saudis so many bombs, which means they must also be held to account for this humanitarian catastrophe in The Hague. After 6 years, it's safe to debate that Saudi Arabia and its criminal allies failed to win the protracted war. This is an important sign that international pressure is building on the U.S. and the Saudi coalition because of the many documented war crimes that they have committed in broad daylight. The call for ending the war is 6 years late, but it is nonetheless welcomed by the international civil society. Unfortunately, the war criminals ignore the call to end the war, just as they are ignoring the conditions set by the UN for an immediate ceasefire. The UN will have to do much more than that if they are going to force the US and NATO to cut off the Saudis and their allies. Challenging their unlawful support that have only led to the killing of innocent men, women, and the elderly is the only sure way to do this. It is essential that the UN recognize that the war on Yemen is both abhorrent and illegal, and they must put a stop to it. Just as the way the senseless military campaign failed to restore Saudi Arabia's desired status quo throughout the region, it has also failed to serve U.S. and Western interests. On the contrary, the murderous rampage has undermined U.S. and Western security, bolstered Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and made many Western governments complicit in numerous war crimes. Their participation in the war has been a shameful and ugly affair that will go down as one of the worst policies in modern history. As maintained by the UN, however, there must be a sustained ceasefire right now in order to get the people and resources into Yemen that are necessary to stop the bloodshed and the famine. Under the circumstances, it is hardly surprising that the US government would be directly responsible if things continue to go from bad to worse in the winter. In this pandemic season of ours, the US government has put more effort into this war than any Western government. It has been out on the hustings in Saudi Arabia from early moments of the military campaign to sell the products of America's largest arms makers. And that the performance will never end under Joe Biden's presidency is beyond dispute. Now that Biden is slated to take office as the 46th president of the United States, he should address the most daunting problems first. Nowhere is there more at the stake than when it comes to how he should handle America's highly militarized foreign policy in the West Asia region, particularly in Yemen. At a time when the pandemic and the famine pose the greatest threats to the safety and security of the Yemeni people, ending America's support for the Saudi-led war should be considered as top priority. Unfortunately, the Pentagon regime and the arms industry have yet to get the message too. Instead, the big-ticket war profiteers continue to assure their partners in crime in Riyadh and elsewhere that the Biden administration may not significantly reduce the Pentagon regime's military interventions in the West Asia region. Just like their predecessors, the Biden administration will never end America's endless wars, much less provide an effective and humane solution to the problem of millions of desperate civilians in Yemen.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.